On this same Sunday in 2004, Desmond Tutu began a sermon with words about an ancient heresy. Long, long ago, very clever people decided that the human body, flesh, all material things, that all of these were in and of themselves evil, intrinsically, inherently, and always. So there was no way that the good, the pure, the sublime, and by definition the perfectly good spirit could be united with the material. But these people, the incarnation, God, pure spirit, becoming a human being, was totally and in principle and always out of the question. What people thought was God become flesh in Jesus Christ, well, that was all just play acting, a charade. The incarnation hallows flesh. Yet those old suspicions are still with us, and nowhere more so than when it comes to sex. At creation, the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed. The body and sex, good and pure. But then, the eyes of both were opened and they knew that they were naked. I heard the sound of you in the garden and I was afraid because I was naked. Sex and the body have become shameful and bad. What has gone wrong? What happened in the Garden of Eden is not history. It is a theological narrative told about human beings, which is intended to explain why the world into which we emerge as conscious beings is not the perfect world we dream of. Nakedness ought to be innocent, but once our eyes are opened to sexuality, we are expelled from Eden. Our bodies become a source of confusion and shame, a process we all negotiate with varying degrees of difficulty. Why did sex and guilt come to be so closely associated, even at this early stage, in human thought? Musing on the fall around 400 AD, St. Augustine famously argued that original sin was transmitted through the lust which accompanied intercourse, and his own struggles with sex are documented with painful honesty in his confessions. He couldn't reconcile the love he had for the woman he lived with and the son they had produced with his conversion to Christianity, and in the end he left her and embraced chastity. Augustine was a great theologian, but left a very negative influence on Western thought when it came to sex. The problem surely comes from our unconscious selves. It hits us just as we are beginning to negotiate the tricky transition from childhood to adulthood. It thrills, appalls, and shames us all at once. Here we become most aware of our animal nature. The pressures it exerts can be urgent and all-consuming. They efface rationality and escape our conscious control. Sometimes they lead us into behaviour we later regret, especially if we have hurt someone else. So sex connects with deep, often unrecognized emotions. It can appeal to our desire to exert power over others, or to submit to them, or to use them for our own ends. In the biblical poetry of the Song of Songs, we find a very different picture of sexuality from the guilt of Adam or Augustine. It sings of a love between equals, a love which transforms each into the other in images drawn from creation itself, lilies and spices, springtime and birds, vines, apples, pomegranates, honey, breezes. At its heart is another garden to which the lovers repair to join in union. The whole creation unites to celebrate with them. It is a much more beautiful and positive picture of the possibilities of erotic love than Genesis offers. So how do we make that biblical journey from sexuality which is guilt-laden to integrating it into our own self-understanding and our relationships with those to whom we are attracted? People of my generation and older have lived through a period of rapid transition in attitudes towards sexual behaviour. I've been fortunate to spend my working life with educated young adults. They expect to live together before they marry, if they marry at all. They consider same-sex attraction as a natural variant. It simply isn't an issue for them. Sometimes I get the impression that the churches are living in a parallel fantasy universe in which everyone marries, marriages last for a lifetime, divorce never happens, no one has sex before marriage, and all homosexual people must abstain, or worse still, be cured. The truth is that even marriage has changed. Until the Married Women's Property Acts of 1870 and 1882, all the property of a married woman belonged to her husband. And she could neither own property nor enter into legal contracts in her own right. Sure, you don't want to go back there. The Victorians were not afraid to tackle injustices. Marriage used to be defined as a lifelong union between a man and a woman, and divorce was virtually impossible. My father's divorce in 1940 was considered a great stain on his character, and the London Missionary Society, for whom he had been working in Madagascar, refused to send him on another posting, since it was scandalous for a nonconformist minister to have been divorced. That's changed. In 2011, 47% of babies were born outside a married relationship in these islands. Whereas when I was growing up, so-called illegitimate birth was a source of shame. There were clergy in the 1980s, maybe there still are, who would not conduct marriages for people who lived at the same address. But by and large, we have got used to cohabitation. Many couples who live together in mutual commitment without being married raise families in a context as loving and stable as that of marriage, and sometimes more so. Premarital sex, what used to be called when I was a kid fornication, forbidden in the New Testament rather more often than homosexual practice, was regularly condemned by the churches. You don't hear much of that now. When I was young, people were being imprisoned for engaging in homosexual acts or being given aversion therapy by electric shock to cure them, in inverted commas. You may remember the tragic case of Alan Turing, the brilliant father of computer science, whose work at Bletchley Park during the war was so important in cracking the German codes. He was prosecuted for homosexuality in 1952, accepted chemical castration in lieu of imprisonment, but killed himself by swallowing cyanide at the age of 52 shortly afterwards. I honestly can't say that I want to thunder from the pulpit against modern mores, especially when they are more accepting and more compassionate than the attitudes with which I grew up. The church needs to reflect carefully on advances in scientific understanding about human sexuality. Some people think that this undermines biblical authority, but it doesn't. It's the flat refusal of fundamentalists to be honest which does the real harm and relegates faith to childish fantasy. We stopped believing that the Earth was at the centre of the solar system, let alone the universe, when it became clear in the 17th century that it wasn't. Slavery was abolished despite the fact that the Bible appears to condone it. We stopped reading the Genesis story of creation as if it was science and have read it as it should be read, as theological narrative telling us about the meaning of creation, that it is good, for example, not offering an alternative to the Big Bang or evolution. Science has sent us back to the scriptures, and we have discovered new and better interpretations. In most surveys, conservatively, somewhere between 2 to 4% of the population identify themselves as homosexual, while a larger number claim to have felt some kind of same-sex attraction. This means that in the UK, there are somewhere between 1 million and 2.5 million gay people, over 100,000 of whom have entered into civil partnerships in the 6 years since it became possible, five times the predicted take-up. Scientists have observed homosexual behaviour in some 1,500 animal species. It is apparently especially prevalent among rams, about 10% of which will not mate with females, which must be very annoying for farmers who buy them. We shouldn't ignore these things when doing our theology. We can't, for example, say that homosexuality is an aberration because it only occurs in some humans. You probably have no idea of the anger and pain which gay people feel towards the church, but I hear it all the time. And I want to say it's not like that, but I can't, because so often it is. We have heard some very inappropriate and offensive language from some church leaders of late in respect of same-sex marriage, which seems to fall well short of the simple test that we should treat others as we would like to be treated ourselves. God created us as beings with sexuality and with the capacity to express ourselves through it. Our sexual orientation is an integral part of who we are and belongs to our God-given humanity. We can use it to demean ourselves and others, or to enhance and complete us as people. And that surely is the area in which a Christian view of sexuality does have something important to say to a Western culture marked by an almost senseless and blind seeking after the pleasures of purely physical sensation and self-gratification, the casualties of which are all around us in the abusive relationships we hear about and those we don't. We need to rediscover the incarnational and sacramental understanding of the material world which doesn't reject it as fallen or wicked, but sees it as the place which God has embraced and made his own. And in that respect, the Song of Songs is a powerful ally, a celebration of the beauties of creation applied to a human relationship characterized by mutuality, intimacy, and tenderness, and for many centuries understood as the closest likeness possible in human language to the love song between God and the human soul, you and me. And so too is the eloquent hymn in 1 Corinthians 13, that love the Greeks called agape, which loves without expecting anything back, purely for the sake of loving. As Paul might put it now, I may hold every politically correct attitude, but if I speak without love, it's noise in the wind. I may have great intellectual powers or faith strong enough to move mountains, but without love, they're worth nothing. I can wear myself out in good works, but if they're done without love, I'm none the better for it. And more freely paraphrasing, I may thank the Lord, be happy in a conventional relationship, but if I have no love of the kind that stretches out to those who aren't and sees in them the image of the divine, I am none the better for it. We live our spiritual lives through living our physical lives, including, obviously, sex. Christians believe that sex is one of many divine gifts given for the building up of one another in love. A Christian approach celebrates the values of intimacy, tenderness, and mutuality, which are the polar opposites of sex as chase, possession, and self-gratification. It understands our bodies to have sacramental value as the forms through which we express our love to God and to one another. Every Christian is called to be a sacrament of Christ. Sacraments are incarnational. They hold together the realms of the spiritual and the physical, which we normally force apart. They are rooted in earthly matter and basic bodily needs, but their source is divine grace, rebirth, redemption. When it comes to sexuality, it's time we stop thinking and reasoning like children. It's time to grow into a mature kind of loving where we are not boastful or arrogant or rude, where our sexuality, whatever its orientation, is no longer defined as appetite and gratification, but helps to build relationships which mirror the divine. Amen.